Hi, everybody. I'm Suzanne Ross, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this second episode in our series, Raven Reviews, Election 2016. Our goal is to bring you some in-depth conversations about topics that maybe are being given short attention spans in mainstream media. We're going to be inviting some of our favorite thinkers to talk to us about issues of politics, religion, democracy, racism, and scapegoating. So we hope you will join us for upcoming interviews. Next week, we're going to be discussing the risks of tyranny in a democracy and terrorism with philosopher of ethics, Paul Dumochel. And this week, of course, we're discussing racism with our friend Melvin Bray, who I will be introducing you to shortly. So if you'd like to see how to participate in upcoming calls or to see recordings of our past calls, you just go to the Raven website, look on the sidebar, or click on events, and you'll find all you need. So today, it is my pleasure to be speaking with my friend Melvin Bray. How you doing, Melvin?
I'm doing well. How about yourself, Suzanne?
Pretty good. You're calling in from Atlanta, right?
Atlanta, Georgia, yes. That's where my family and I have made our home. We tried to move away, and it kept calling us back, so we came back.
Yeah, home has a way of doing that. That's true. Well, Melvin, I gave our talk today a title, and I'm calling it, Am I a Racist? Confronting Our Blind Spots. And the reason I gave it that title is that you, my friend, have changed the way I answer that question.
Wow.
You've opened up my awareness to some blind spots I wasn't aware of. And I have a feeling I've got a few more that maybe need to be dealt with. So this might be a little therapy session for me today. Who knows? But I'm really happy to have you here to talk with us. And I'm really happy we're recording it, because for those people who can't be here live, they can, I think, really benefit from the conversation. So, Melvin.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me, Suzanne, for sure.
Well,
and I know we have friends who would love to get in on the conversation. It being in the middle of the day may make that difficult, but yes, being able to access it after the fact will be great.
Will be great, yes. Good. Well, Melvin, we're going to have your bio, posted with the interview, but just the recording, but just to introduce you by saying you're an Emmy Award-winning storyteller, a writer, an editor, an educator, and you've also been very instrumental in two festival events, if you will, that places I've met you, the Wild Goose Festival and at the Faith Forward gatherings. So, but you call yourself something that I'm not sure I've ever heard someone call themselves before, a social entrepreneur. And I wondered if you could tell us what that is and why you is one.
So social entrepreneurship is a thing, but it's not a language that has currency within faith circles a whole lot. It's perhaps developing more. What social entrepreneurship speaks to is this notion that a lot of people are out here taking risks in the effort to make money, but those risks to make profit don't have to be exclusive of purpose. And so social entrepreneurs go into the idea of starting a business in hopes of starting something that will speak to a critical need in the world, whether it be needs around ecological concerns, whether it be needs around how youth development, whether it be needs around how government, NGO work, you know, bringing electricity to places that don't have electricity, all these kinds of things, right? And so my kind of social entrepreneurship centers around the fact that I have a small consulting firm that works primarily with nonprofit organizations who are looking to do justice work in the world. And what I do is I do what's called design-based collaborative problem solving. And that's a long description for the fact that I seem to have a little bit of skill at putting people in the room and getting them involved in the right processes where they start to think creatively about innovation or about the problems they've been facing, intractable problems, and figure out that they already have the answers. They just didn't know how to talk to each other about it yet. Yeah. And so you know, we get them talking to each other about it, and they get to see those opportunities, and collaboratively, they come up with solutions to the things that matter to them most.
Wow. Well, I have seen you in a room, and you are an excellent facilitator. You do get people talking. You really do. And it is a wonderful experience rather than just being talked at and told what to do. Yeah. There's this feeling of discovery and excitement in the room when you're leading a project.
You know, for me, it's really it's a blessing to be in this space at this time in life, right? So right around 40, I was trying to figure out what's the next 20 years going to look like. And, you know, I have a certain set of skills, I guess, gifts that since childhood people thought were meant to push me out in front, you know, kind of working in front of groups of people and such. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I'm realizing is that the problems that we face today are problems that people who have been in traditionally power over positions aren't going to be able to solve, right? So they're not problems that white people, males, upper class folk, extremely educated folk are going to be the ones who are really going to be able to lead us out of. And so my goal now is to, like, how can I be in support of women, particularly women of color, particularly queer folk, who because of their unique kind of social positioning are I believe, in best positioned and best experienced to help us deal with some of these intractable problems, to lead us as we deal with some of these intractable problems that face us now. Around sexism, heterosexism, racism, you know, these things.
Well, sure. I mean, you're talking about giving voice to people that haven't been part of the narrative of either what the problem is or how to solve it. So, yeah. You know, that's what brings us to that's coming out. It's in January, right? The publication.
Yes, it's coming out in January, and thank God that's not the cover, right? So we are just now settling on a better cover for the book entitled "Better: Waking Up to Who We Could Be," and
there is. Oh, you're hilarious. But see, that's why, you know, the publication and publishing process takes a while.
Yes.
To get going. But, you know, what you talk about in Better, I'm very pleased to have an advanced copy of it because it really, you're inviting us to tell better stories about our lived experiences together, but also about our faith stories and the way we've been passing on faith stories that in a way have been counterproductive, haven't been helping us solve problems.
That's exactly.
So, and especially, Melvin, you were very open and honest in discussing your experiences of being a Black man reading the Bible and of being a Black man in situations, in groups and gatherings and in America, what that's like. And so I wanted to talk with you about racism also in the context of the election as well. But before we dive into all those different areas, I was wondering if we could just sort of talk a little bit about just what is racism? How do we define it? Because I think, as you pointed out, sometimes we define it in ways that maybe let ourselves off the hook a little bit. So let's let you tell us. How do you think of that?
That's interesting. How I think about it. First, if I can, Suzanne, let me also clarify one thing previously, and that is that, like, the work, as I think about the work I do, it's really not about giving voice as much as it is about amplifying voice and supporting those who are stepping into their voice, who are using their voice, because, you know, like, part of it is me recognizing, like, the limits of my own power, right? And my agency, and encouraging people in their own agency, right? So in some weird way, that kind of relates to this question about racism, right? Because one of the things I think about is, like, I don't get to have my own definition of racism, right? Like, you know, that whatever our definition of racism is, it needs to be rooted in grounded in study in this field, right? And so there is a field regarding critical race theory, and that uses critical race theory. Critical race theory comes up in Black feminist political discussion. It comes up in all sorts of places across. But there's a field of study here, right? And basically, kind of a working definition, right? So first thing I'm going to do is encourage those who want to enter into this conversation. And if you enter into it, it's not about just entering it into it with your feelings. It's about entering into it with your own with a sense of curiosity, and taking the time to read and study those who've come before this thing and studied this thing deeply. Right. So, kind of the working definition I use, layman's definition, is that racism is a system. Right. And when I say system, I'm talking about a system of laws, a system of practices, economic structures, religious structures, all of a system that privileges, that whose purpose is to, or that's the purpose of which is to privilege white people, and just as importantly with the definition, to unprivilege people of color. Mm-hmm. Racism is a system, right? So to think about it like this. I was amazingly, two nights ago, my children decided to ask me what racism was.
Oh, did you?
Just totally unprovoked, right? And so, you know, I kind of give them that definition, but then I tried to make an analogy with them. I said, think about it like this. What part of the lawnmower cuts the grass? And so, of course, one of them went for, you know, the blade, right? Well, actually, the blade doesn't cut the grass. You can take a blade and you can lay it out there on the sidewalk and it's not going to do anything. And you can lay it on the grass, it's not going to do anything. And particularly if the blade's not sharp, right? So there's even a part of that part of the system that isn't even a part of the whole. It's an outside part that intervenes, right? And then one of my children said, well, it's the motor, right? It's the motor that does it. Well, no, you can take it out there. You can even put gas in that motor. You can start that motor, and it'll just sit there, right? It'll just sit there. And so you can add the housing to it. You can add the wheels to it. You can put the blade on the spindle on the bottom of the motor. You can make sure your spark plug is firing right. You can pull that thing. And even that whole thing humming on isn't going to cut grass, because it requires some agency outside of itself, even in operation, right? And so the system is the entirety of the thing working together. No one part actually commits the act of cutting the grass, just like no one part of our system necessarily commits the act of racial discrimination, right? But working in concert, the way the pieces work together, they create the racial discrimination. They privilege people of particular descent, and they unprivilege people of another descent. And then you have persons who are operating as agents or with agency within the system to carry out certain pieces of it. And so in that sense, that the system, like the lawnmower, right, is the lawnmower, but also the person who is the agent is the lawnmower, quite literally, too. And so when we use the term of racist, right, we're saying if you are a part of this system,
right,
and you participate in the privileging of yourself or in the unprivileging of others, whether intentionally or intentionally, then that makes you a part of the system, and so the terms that refer to the system refer to you too.
Right.
Right? So racist.
Right. That's where you really got me thinking, because the way you're talking about this, if you're benefiting somehow from the functioning of the system, and I thought, well, how the heck could I not be benefiting? I just by the accident of my birth and color and so forth, whether I choose or not choose to, I'm part of it. And so how do you think about that? You know, when I say, I'm asked the question, I am a racist, I quickly say, well, I don't want to be, you know, that's not my want to be. So what's a helpful way then to think about, not just throwing up your hands and say, well, there's nothing I can do because the system's there and I'm in it, you know?
Yeah, so there's a part of me that wants to think I have some answers to that question. There's another part of me that recognizes that, like, I just have a different experience on the other side of that system, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I'll make some observations, but, I wouldn't say, these are authoritatively the things, right? One thing to recognize is that racism is not about how you feel about a person.
Yeah.
So when people start talking about this being a racist system that is predicated on a philosophy of white supremacy and supported by structures like white objectivity, right? Then they are not saying you feel a certain way towards black people and that's your problem.
Yeah.
Right? It's not about that at all. It's about being involved in a process that is meant to privilege you in certain ways while it unprivileges other people in other ways. And how you feel about it doesn't affect that system.
Mm-hmm.
What affects the system is how you choose to be in relationship to it. Right? And so this is where we get into questions about dismantling racism. Right? Dismantling whiteness, right? If the designation of the term white historically exists to privilege a particular group of people, it's to say you are not them and therefore certain things belong to you.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things are all right for you. Certain ways of being in the world, no matter how hostile, still carry the blessing of our community, right?
Mm-hmm.
If the very term is meant to do that, right?
Yeah.
Then when we talk about anti-whiteness, right, or dismantling whiteness, right, mm-hmm. what we're saying is, hey, this thing is so deeply written that there's some things you're going to have to give up in order to be a part of what is becoming. And so that's why someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates would use language like those who believe themselves to be white, right? What he's saying is there's a particular choice to position yourself in this system that privileges some and unprivileges others. There's a particular choice that you make, and there's a particular decision in it, and you can choose otherwise. It's also the reason that people of color can still participate in white supremacy. Because they can make the choice
mm-hmm.
to hold and privilege particular notions about who we should be in the world, right? Versus they can choose another way, a more healthy way of being in the world that's not antagonistic to others, that's not hostile, that doesn't seek to rationalize immorality. You know, these kinds of things.
Yeah, that's really helpful, because I never, you know, really thought about whiteness as an identity that's been constructed and given to me, that it isn't something that just, you know, fell from heaven.
Like we can point to a point in history before people call themselves white.
Yeah.
And we can point to a point in history where whiteness became a thing.
Yeah.
And how it was used and why it was used. And then when it was actually, you know, initially, there was still a lot of delineation, even in our own laws here in the United States, between if you were white, male, and landed, had land, versus if you were anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can point to the discussions. Like, we can look at the discussions in books like A People's History of the United States. We can look at the discussions that were had that said, now, if we aren't careful, these poor white folk are going to unite with the enslaved black folk and the indigenous folk, and they're going to overthrow us.
Uh-huh.
So we need to create some designation here that gets poor white people to think of themselves, well, at least I'm not black,
mm-hmm.
right? Or at least I'm not Native American. And so then laws begin to be constructed, and social practices begin to be constructed, and even categories of employment begin to be constructed in order to create that designation of white, not rich, not landed, but at least not a person of color.
Right. Right. So, yeah, it is a question of identity and drawing those boundaries between who's in and out. And as you say, we can choose to accept all or none of an identity that's being handed to us. But you have to be aware that option is there, you know. I want to just sort of shift a little to the election and ask you, I mean, where do you see problematic conversations happening? Where do you see any good ones happening? Would be better. Maybe a shorter interview if we went. How are issues of systemic racism showing up for you in the election, in the campaigns?
Oh my goodness! Right, so. Yeah, you're right. Like, we could go on ad nauseum about where it's showing up. It's showing up everywhere. Two places kind of jump out at me as being important to name. And one is it's showing up in the way the electoral campaigns run themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I say that, I'm talking about just all of electoral politics in the United States, and particularly kind of the two big parties, the DNC and the RNC. And I'm looking at the choices that are being made for who will represent us, what their platforms are, what strategies are used to get people to the polls, whether or not we seek to change the electoral map. You know, for example, one thing that jumps out at me is that this should be a runaway election for Hillary Clinton. Because she's running against someone who is just so far beyond the pale that he shouldn't even be a viable consideration. And so then, you know, Democrats poke fun at Republicans. Oh, they're dumb, they're stupid, they're bigots, they're this, they're that, right? And that bigotry is real, right? But what I do, what I look at is, why is our thing so close? First off, these folk aren't dumb, right? They're appealing to some real or perceived needs that are being expressed by particular people.
Right.
And those people are coming out to vote. But those needs don't represent all of the country. But here's the problem. You go to a place like Georgia, where Georgia elections in Georgia, whether Georgia is a blue state or a red state, is determined by about 100, somewhere between 150,000 and 200,000 votes.
Yeah.
All the DNC would have to do is register 200,000 people, 250,000 people who are not registered to vote. And if they choose to do this voter registration campaigning in communities of color, 90-some-odd percent of those people are going to vote Democratic for the Democratic Party. So why isn't that happening in Georgia as a massive push from the top of the Democratic Party? From what I understand, Texas elections are decided by about 900,000 votes. So it's a red state by about 900,000 votes. Well, apparently there are 3 million, count them, 3 million. That's more than three times the number of folk who decide elections in Texas. There are 3 million eligible Latino voters who have not been registered. What is that? How is that not the thing to be about? In my analysis, the only reason can be that somehow either white votes are being privileged as being the only important votes, or people are running from the inevitable shifts in power that occur when you add more people to the system.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happens in terms of how money is spent around whether we're going to do television ads or we're going to do get out the vote, door-to-door knocking. The same white male, primarily, consultants are hired to do that work, to advise the campaign on what strategies to use where, and they come back to the table, say, hey, we need to do these commercials on these in these spaces at these time slots. Well, why? Because they make 15% on those buys. So every time $1 million is spent on a television commercial, $150,000 or so is goes in the pocket of these same consultants who know nothing about this group of people who could vote but aren't likely voters, and so they don't put any efforts towards it. If the same money were spent on grassroots efforts, you'd get more voters into the system, but these same people who have been in power wouldn't get paid the same way. And so,
right.
Even though every single scholarly study that's ever been done on commercials and political times says that it's a waste of money, we still put that money, the same people, the same primarily white people, overwhelmingly white people, who run the political organizations, keep making the same decisions and keep getting the same results, and even to the point of risking losing. That's racism.
That is, I mean, it's an excellent point to say that if you empower people, bring them into the system by registering to them to vote, they ain't always going to vote the way you want them to either, you know, because...
Exactly. Or they're going to make demands.
Pardon me?
Or they're going to make demands, right? They're going to require something. Right?
Yes.
Like you know, what's ludicrous to me is that Hillary Clinton, as much as she's the only bot, even if it's between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, there is no possible way that on its rational face, you can arrive at, yeah, Donald Trump. But Hillary Clinton would rather risk losing than say, hey, I'm going to bring these new people in, and then I'm going to convince them to get excited about voting for me by giving them the things that matter to them. So the economic plan put forth by BY100, right? Check that out if you've never seen it, right? This is saying this is an economic plan that would benefit people of color in this country and help correct some of the wrongs that have historically been done. The Campaign Zero is a plan for how to remedy or begin to remedy some the problems around state-sponsored or state-sanctioned, not state-sponsored, but state-sanctioned murder of people of color by police. Right? Mm. She hasn't said, yeah, that's what I'm gonna do. She hasn't said, hey, let me look at this Black Lives Matter platform and see what parts of it we can incorporate. No commitments have been made there. No commitments to block grants and for institutions and communities of color. No particular commitments to small businesses run by minority small businesses supported by the SBA. Nothing. She has offered nothing.
Yeah.
To say, get excited about me. That again,
yeah,
is part of the racism, because the assumption is, well, you might as well vote for us.
Yeah,
we're better than the other guy. Forget what matters to you.
Yeah,
we're your only option.
Yeah, it's not. It begins to feel like you say that people would rather risk losing than risk sharing power. You talk about, you tell a compelling story in Better about your experience of rarely finding white men. You indict white men. Phew, let me off the hook there. You indict white men, but they travel in packs and they rarely give up power. I found that really interesting because, I know a lot of white liberal men who believe in their hearts that they are sharing power, and willing to share power, but maybe they're not succeeding in a way that that they're imagining.
Well, we have this thing about this notion of. And we try not to use language of tokenism, right? But it's this tokenism, right? As long as there is a black face involved or an Asian face involved, or then we've shared power.
Right.
And that's not how that works. Like, we live in a country where only 62% of the people in the country now. And it's probably less than that, are white people. That means close to 40, if not 40% of the country already are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, like, if power sharing is happening, right, then resources should be channeled across that spectrum,
yeah,
in proportional ways. If power sharing is happening, then decision making should be channeled across that spectrum in proportional ways, and within reasonably proportional ways, right? And so on and so forth. So yeah, there's a difference between actually sharing power and talking about sharing power.
Yeah. Yep, because actually doing it would mean giving up some power. I mean, it would mean stepping off stage for a minute or into the back, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I thought that was, it's funny because we have a, not to get too off track, but we have a friend, Michael Kerwin, who's a priest thinking really hard about what's happening in the Catholic Church and wondering how white male priests can get out of the way of the work that the Spirit is doing, renewing the church from global renewal that's going place. And white men tend to be a little resistant to the work of the Spirit. But anyway, it's that notion of if you're in a position of power, there's really very little motivation to let go. aside from an one, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, that, you know, and I think really we need to talk more honestly about how invested certain people are in certain things, right? Like, you know, I grew up in a church where they talked about the headship of men. You know, men were the leaders and meant to be leaders, and God ordained men to be leaders. Well, you know, if you grow up in a male-dominated space, then it's easy to get invested in your turn. Yeah. To participate in that in that power dynamic, and so you find yourself, whether consciously or unconsciously, kind of just not kind of working against any change in that paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. And even if quite often, you know, we'll say, well, yeah, women are a part of this thing, but they find themselves answering to men for the choices they make, right? Like, mm-hmm. And so that same kind of That same kind of thing, that interrogation of power, becomes deeply important. And part of what makes racism racism is we're talking about power being leveraged. Power being leveraged. And you can't have a conversation about dismantling racism without talking about changing the way power is leveraged and who gets to leverage it.
Yeah.
If we have that going on in the political election right now, one of the other things that would be different would be the terms that we use to talk about things. Now, I started jotting down certain terms, right? Now, you know, this isn't about whether a person is lying or not. We have a lot of just outright lying mm-hmm. within the election, right? Folk who say things and then say, I didn't say that, right? And even though we live in an age where everything gets recorded and everything gets kept, it's not like it disappears, right? It's still, it's like I didn't say it, I'm going to stick with it. So it's that old Saturday Night Live. That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah.
So I'm not talking about the lying that happens within the election. What lets me know that racism is alive and well in the language that's being used and that power hasn't shifted or isn't being shared is just the language constructs that people come up with. Like, so you have this language from one party that says, make America great again. And, of course, any person of color is going to look at that and say, so when was America great? Tell me what time we want to go back to. Because I'll tell you that more than likely, my story was on the losing end of that greatness, mm-hmm. not on the participation in that quote-unquote greatness, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But the other side isn't a whole lot better. Like, they use this language of better together, right? Better together, which you know, on its face sounds really good. Like, I'm all for better. I got a book named Better. But when you heard it framed at the Democratic National Convention, there was this particular kind of ahistorical framing that was just aggravating for anyone who's a person of color and knows history, right? Because it was, we have always been a nation that believed we are better together. When was that? Right? Like the Revolutionary War isn't us always being a nation. The Civil War isn't us always being a nation. What happened to soldiers of color who went and fought World War One or World War Two? That doesn't tell that story, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, the enslavement of black people, you know, when we're talking about trillions of dollars of wealth being created on this thing, that doesn't speak to we have always been a nation that understood we are better together, right? Yeah. The first anti-immigration laws written against Asian Americans does not speak of that, right? The war we picked with Mexico to steal Kansas and Utah and Texas and California and New Mexico and Arizona from then Mexico, and then the letting the Mexicans who were now on this side of the border stay, and then running them out, and then calling them back, and then running them out, and then calling them back. And that doesn't speak to a country mm-hmm. that believes that has always believed we are better together. So both sides use language
that
shows that there are not people
from
all swaths, all communities, who are able to speak into what is the language that speaks to the truth about who we are, what we need to do to work on, and who we want to be.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that historical amnesia or whatever, blindness, I feel for you, Melvin. I can only imagine how frustrating that's got to be, to have to sit and listen to that from people who say they've got your best interests at heart, no less. You know, that's got to be very frustrating. Which sort of brings me to something I also wanted to talk with you about, which is sort of two things that are coming together for me, which is how you do impact these narratives that seem to just keep perpetuating the bad stories about who we are, that are either incomplete or just outright lies. With the history of things, the new movie that's going to be released, I think tomorrow is the release date, Birth of a Nation, is a really interesting movie. You and I both have been able to see screenings of it before the release, so we've both seen the movie, and I'm just struck by the deliberate use of that title, Birth of a Nation, as a invoking the 1915 movie Birth of a Nation, which, you know, told one narrative of white power and showed it as something marvelous or whatever, and then the new movie, which is attempting to say, hey, you know, that use of white privilege and power didn't turn out well for a lot of people. So what I was interested just to talk with you about, because the movie is told that from is telling the story of Nat Turner, who led a very violent slave revolt, about 30
most successful slave revolt in the country.
Really?
But
it was about 30. Say that again.
I said, but even it was stopped. It was brought down.
It was very short lived. So what I would love to talk with you about, the way in which Nat Turner is portrayed in the movie as having to, you know, I don't know what slavery was like. I wasn't there. I've seen some movies and read some books and whatever, but this attempt to show how surviving in a system like that was so brutal, what it does to someone's sense of self, their identity, the just internal compromises that had to be made. I thought it was very powerful in that somehow they let us get inside this character and see the struggle to just hold his head up on a daily basis. I wonder if you could speak about how you reacted to that portrayal of an enslaved man with a good heart and a big brain, and, you know, how did you react to it?
Well, you know, it was a moment. To see it portrayed was a moment of pride for me, right? So Nat Turner has always been one of my heroes. In my classroom, when I used to teach high school, I put up different people for my students to see the influences in my life, and Nat Turner's picture was always one of those. So Nat Turner, to see his story on the big screen is to say, is to claim certain things. And it's also a testament to what happens when power is shared, when the power to shape story, to tell story, isn't just limited to a few or a particular group of people. And so you know, Nat Turner's rebellion is usually framed as, is usually discredited with language around it was an act of violence. And that language, even when it's not intended to be discredited, that language itself calls what he did into question, right? I would like to point out a few things. That language starts at secondly, as if violence starts with Nat Turner, and it does not. The brutalization starts long before Nat Turner's story. And so Nat Turner is a person who says that we cannot continue to be brutalized, to be subject to violence, and hold on to our fragile humanity. That is, that these people are consciously seeking to rip from us. And we know this to be true. This isn't interpretation, right? This was chattel slavery. It was called by the people who came up with it as the peculiar institution. No version of forced labor that preceded it in recorded history or that has come after it in recorded history has been on its same terms, because chattel slavery was an attempt to dehumanize a group of people, to say, you are chattel. You are not human. You do not have the rights of a human. You are just not a conquered people. You are subhuman. And therefore, you have no rights. You get to be treated however we need to treat you in order to exploit you and get out of you what we want. Mm-hmm. And here was a person who said, this far and no further. Mm-hmm. No more. I will not accept this assault, this pillaging of my body. I will not accept this assault, this pillaging of my mind. I will not accept this assault, this pillaging of my faith, right, or my future, or my children's future. I am going to do something about it, and I'm going to do it on whatever terms bring it to an end. And so it was those who created the system of racist bondage, enslavement, who set the terms. We are willing to protect this with our lives. We fought a whole big war over it, where people gave their lives for the right to continue this thing. And he met them on their terms, which that sounds to me more like self-defense than it does violence. Mm-hmm. And even if we, and what I'm calling into question is the binary of the philosophical binary of violence and nonviolence. Right?
Yeah.
And even if we do say that it is violence, I would suggest that self-defense is an act of necessary preservation of life, mm-hmm. not an act of selfish taking of life, which then changes the terms that we should be using in relationship to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very brings things up to the present day, too, because this language of violence and nonviolence, we hear it in the protest movements against police violence and everyone from within the Black community, with outside the Black community, especially people in positions of government and authority, say, please just be nonviolent in your protests, and
starting the story at secondly, right? That's what that is, right? We're going to be violent first, but then secondly, be nonviolent in response.
Yeah, which this is another area where you've really challenged my thinking, because I began to see the hypocrisy of calls for nonviolence coming out of the mouths of the system that's oppressing through the use of violence. Like, our violence is okay, yours is not. The movie is so striking, Melvin, because it doesn't shy away from showing the violence in both sides of the spectrum. The violence is violent. I mean, you can't, the slave owner violence against Nat and the fellow slaves, there's some brutal scenes in there, and especially violence against women and so forth. It just, you can't, it pokes the hole in the whole, that's good violence, you know, that is necessary or good or whatever. But yet, you know, you're still hearing people criticize the movie and criticize Nat Turner's response of saying, oh, well, now you're valorizing his violence. Then that, you know, the movie portrayed him so heroically. I mean, how do you answer that critique or whatever?
Well, it goes back to our broader theme about racism, right? So it's part of a supremacist logic, right? That says first off that what white people do is all whatever it is that white people choose to do is always justifiable. Yeah. Right? Didn't say justified, but it's justifiable. There is a rationale that can be offered that can render it innocent. Right? That's a part of a supremacist logic. That is a logic that says certain people belong on top and other people don't. And so as long as the top people have done it, then it's worth debating whether or not it is justifiable. And in the debate, what do we do? We end up giving credibility where credibility doesn't belong, right? I don't know what's happening with the screen right now. It happened with you a little earlier.
Yeah, here you go.
There we go, right? And so that's one of the things that's working in there. It's that language of supremacy. Right? In this instance, it's racial supremacy. In other instances, it's male supremacy. In other instances, so supremacy can show up in a lot of different places, right? But in that instance, it's racial supremacy, right? So that's where the conversation starts, right? That this is justifiable. Now, again, we have to look at terms, right? We have to look at the terms upon which the conversation has been set. The rape, the kidnapping, the abject poverty, the lack of self-determination, the force feeding that's demonstrated in it, the being whipped, the being killed if you just will not be broken. Right? Mm-hmm. All of these things were the terms set by the white supremacist system of enslavement of Africans.
Right.
But now, what the notion is, and it should create a whole lot of psychological dissonance, the notion is that the only appropriate response to all of those acts of violence is to allow them to continue until those who are perpetrating them choose out of the goodness of their heart, the conviction of the Holy Spirit, the acknowledgement of wrongdoing and this out of nowhere conversion to the right to stop.
Yeah.
Right. And so what I think is what I'm pushing at is not that one violence is right and the other violence is wrong. What I'm actually pushing at is that the argument about violence is beside the point when as a moral barometer of what is actually wrong.
Right.
In the enslavement of people,
yeah,
dehumanization is the issue. Right? That's of primary importance in that space.
Right. Yeah, you're right. It's just a way to self-justify when and to give yourself the sort of illusion that you're actually talking about violence when you're actually avoiding talking about the real violence that's taking place. I get
Scapegoating. It's your language of scapegoating, right?
Scapegoating, exactly right. Exactly right. And the other thing that came up for me in the movie, and you know, connects with what you've written about in your book Better, is the way the Bible was used to support racism, and the way poor Nat was forced to preach submission to slaves in and around where his master and his master was making money off of him preaching submission to, you know, right out of the Bible. And I think it was,
well, that isn't unique in that sense.
Really,
we got plenty of preachers still doing this work.
Well, hey, God Almighty, that is sadly true. But you know, it gives the Bible kind of a bad name when it can be used. And you know why? Is you're familiar with the history that you know, good Christian folk were absolutely sure that this chattel slavery was something ordained by God and needed to be protected. And so one of the things I'd like to talk with you about is how you're suggesting we begin to reimagine some of these stories and some of these biblical narratives. And I did, I had picked two that, that you dealt with in the book, because they are stories of women who are, you know, victimized and misunderstood. And it's the Ruth and, Hagar are the two stories. And I don't want to keep you too much over the hour. I promised I would keep you. But I did want to just give folks a sense of how you look at those stories with from a different angle and in a way that rescues them, if you will, from this protecting our own power positions as we read them.
So I really appreciate you helping me get around to the work of the book. I am so bad at self-promotion, right? I don't even think about it. And so, yes, our hour has run by. So I'll try not to go too much longer, right? So first, let's make sure we name this truth, that when we say good Christian folk, we need to put those in quotes. Mm-hmm. Those are qualified terms. Don't know how good, right? Don't know how much of a Christ follower would end up in this space, right? But the language is, these are the terms, what we're saying when we say good Christian folk is people who have justified themselves in what they are doing. Mm-hmm. And it raises some really important questions about, like, the good of Christianity, left in Christianity, for those who have been on the losing side of oppressive systems, right? And that might be a conversation for another time in, in another place. But okay, so the whole premise of the work in Better, Waking Up to Who We Could Be, the work that I'm doing in that book hinges on this question: what is the world that exists with all of its racism, sexism, heterosexism, ecological disregard, tribalism, all of it? What if the world that exists is exactly the world we storied into existence with our hostile telling of our faith stories? Mm-hmm. Right? So we take stories that are about virtues, love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, that are about courage and justice and beauty and these sorts of things, and we turn them into stories that glorify our own illegitimate grabs at power, mm-hmm. and our own supremacist logic, And so if it's true that we've storied ourselves into this way of being in the world, into these hostile ways of being in the world, then what I'm proposing is we can story ourselves out of it. We can go back and remember the virtues that gave rise to the stories, right, in which we encoded our aspirations and our hopes and our dreams for what it meant to be truly human. We can go back to those virtues and we can make sure that in our telling of the story, we are reflecting those virtues. And when we're not, we can get rid of that telling, right? So some of our stories are cautionary tales. The two you asked about, stories I use in juxtaposition in one of the chapters in the book to show how our understanding of things can evolve over time, mm-hmm. right? So we initially have the story of Hagar. Now, Hagar is an Egyptian slave who was given as a gift from Pharaoh to Abraham. Which in and of itself is an irony that if it weren't so horrific and heartbreaking, it would be laughable, right? Mm-hmm. Because here an Egyptian is giving a Hebrew a slave. Later on, Hebrews would become slaves for the Egyptians, right? So Pharaoh gives an Egyptian slave to Abraham. She becomes his wife Sarah's handmaiden. Abraham and Sarah have been having trouble conceiving a child. May have been they were too old. You know, Abraham was already in his 80s. But either way, they're having trouble conceiving a child. And what the bright idea that Sarah comes up with is, hey, why don't you take Hagar and conceive a child with her? And everything will be, and then the promises that God made will be fulfilled. So here we go. This brown woman from Egypt is taken. She is likely young, right? She is likely underage. And this is the father and mother of our faith, Christian faith. And what do? They devise a racist, a sexist plan to rape a child for their own benefit mm-hmm. of fulfilling this promise God has given to them. Mm-hmm. That is deeply problematic. And these are the ones we look to as the patriarchs and matriarchs of the faith, right? Right, which in the way we tell that story, in celebrating what happens in that space, what we do is we justify for ourselves a notion of if it fulfills God's promise to me, it's acceptable. It doesn't even matter what it costs and who it hurts and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's supremacist logic mm-hmm. that we've embedded in the story, right? Mm-hmm. About 400 years later, so this is how Abraham and Sarah deal with the quote-unquote other, right? Someone who is not of their people at one point. 400 years later, we actually get a much different story where this woman by the name of Ruth, she is her mother-in-law and father-in-law were Israelites, and their famine came to the land, and they escaped the famine by going over to a place called Moab. And this is where Ruth is from. Well, her mother-in-law and father-in-law have two sons. Those two sons marry, one marries Ruth, the other marries this girl named Orpah. And what ends up happening is that at some point, Ruth's mother-in-law wants to go back home. Her sons have died. Her husband has died. She's all alone in Moab outside of her two daughters-in-law. And she wants to go back to her people. And so she goes back. She makes the long journey back home. And Orpah and Ruth walk with her part of the way. And at some point, Orpah says, well, it's time for me to go back home. And the expectation is that Ruth will go back home too. But then Ruth is torn. And she is torn, and she makes this statement that has become some of the most often quoted language from Scripture. And we think it's so beautiful. She says, "Naomi, wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lie, I will lie. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God." And so Ruth goes back with, she parts with Orpah, that ingrate, you know. Ruth's kind of talking about her, like, how dare she not want to go and live out her days in a place that she knows no one, right? But she goes back home. Ruth and Naomi go back to Israel, and it so happens that, you know, because of the kind of societal practices, Ruth and Naomi find themselves gleaning on farmland that belongs to a cousin of Naomi's, and Ruth catches that cousin's eye, and Ruth ends up marrying the cousin, and there's a whole lot of problematic kind of sexist stuff going on in there, and how that goes down. But Ruth ends up marrying the cousin, and she ends up being the great-great-grandmother, might have just been one great instead of two,
yeah,
of Israel's greatest king, most remembered, most revered king, King David.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets to join the society of Hebrews.
Yeah.
And gets treated very differently. But notice the terms on which she gets treated, right? So like the racism has evolved. The supremacist logic has evolved over time. And in some ways, things have improved, right, for the way women are being treated, for the way that Ruth is treated as a foreigner who is now taken into Israel. But in many ways, it's still based on the same supremacist logic, because she has to abandon her own people,
yeah,
in order to be deemed worthy,
mm-hmm,
of being treated with respect and regard and defining her way into the narrative of Israel, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what the work we're doing in the book, to wrap it up, is just simply to say, we have to tell the truth about these. And I offer a methodology to help people get at some of the truth in these stories,
mm-hmm,
right? We have to tell the truth about these stories, stop making apologies for these stories, stop using them to justify our own supremacist desires, and then use them to set greater aspirations for ourselves,
yeah,
to inspire us to do better, to inspire us to be better, and, yeah, to know that that better is possible.
Yeah, I love your approach, Melvin, because you do say it's not, the problem is not our stories, it's the way we've been telling them. That's the problem. We don't have to throw these stories out. They're rich resources for helping us see ourselves more clearly, more honestly, may require a little repentance, maybe a little enduring of some broken hearts and suffering along the way. But, you know, we don't want
to. Yeah, we just have to uninvest ourselves, or to disinvest ourselves,
yeah,
in being on the side of right,
yeah,
all the time.
All the time. I know. Oh boy, it's so good though to be there. I don't know. But you know what? It's better not to be there. I have to tell you the truth. The times that my heart has been broken open, some in conversation with you, have led me to be more relaxed, more joyful, more whole. And you know, you find out the things you were hanging on to weren't as good as you thought they were.
Yeah.
But you don't find out till you let go. So it's one of those paradoxes, but I'm really, really grateful that you're in my life and in the lives of all of us, as a preacher, as a teacher. And I'm really looking forward to, the new cover, whatever that will look like. I wish you all the best with that. And I hope maybe when the book comes out again, you can come back and we can have a more in-depth discussion about your process of how we go about rereading these stories together. So
that's so kind of you. Thank you so much, Suzanne.
It's been a pleasure, Melvin. Thank you so much. And thank you to folks listening. Melvin, tell us where people can follow you if they want to keep up with
what you're doing. Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. Right. So I have a public page on Facebook. You just type in Melvin Bray. I think it's the third. I think I put the three I's after I had to. And it'll come up. But Melvin Bray should bring it up. If you go to that page and like it, you'll be up to date on everything we do related to the book. There'll be the website will be up shortly. It'll be better.melvinbray.com. And I'm looking forward to interacting with people around it and blessings. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Go and pre-order your book today.
Oh, yes, please, on Chalice Press. Chalice Press's website. If you go to chalicepress.com, they have pre-order available, and that's the best price you can get. I think it's 20% off, right? And
nice.
If you need a discount code, let me give you the discount code.
Oh, nice.
If it doesn't give you the 20, I'm sorry. If it doesn't give you the 20% off right away, let me give you the discount code. Hold on, I got up and now my screen's acting crazy.
There it is.
All you have to do is do coupon code SHIP16. So that's SHIP16, the number 16, and you'll get at least a 20% off of the list price.
Excellent. I'm sure it's worth more than that. But thank you. Thanks so very much. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.